This week on the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast.
The most common cause of acquired hemophilia is autoantibodies against factor VIII.
So when we say mucor, we're of course talking about mucor mycosis.
High output heart failure is a condition in which the cardiac output is greater than the metabolic demand.
This podcast is made by and for our internal medicine residents to enhance their educational experience. The content, while edited by residents, is not verified by hosts or speakers, and we are not content experts in these topics. The content provided by the podcast is not intended and should not construe as medical advice and should not be used to diagnose or treat any medical condition. We attempt to avoid use of opinion, but all opinions are presented are our own and are not representative of the employer. Please keep this in mind as we enjoy our podcast.
Welcome back to the Vanderbilt Internal Medicine Podcast.
Well, I know that Blake really wanted us to say the weather's cooler, but our topics are hot. Something along those lines. We'll just go ahead and plug that right from the get-go.
She's very impressed in the background right now.
Can't take credit for that.
Casey, how have you been?
I've been doing well. It's interview season, so the Zoom fatigue is real. But other than that, how about you?
Yeah, I'm doing well. Hanging out on clinic right now and learning from some great PCPs here at Vanderbilt.
Enjoying our block schedule.
Absolutely.
We also both happen to be on the wellness committee.
That's right. And today we had our wellness picnic. Had a little lunch out in the courtyard today, trying to keep things socially distant, but also trying to bring back a little bit of interaction to our large program and do a little less Zooming.
Also some small barbecue get-togethers at our program director's house, which is very nice of him to offer up that space.
Yeah. You talk about Zoom fatigue. Dr. McPherson's definitely going to have Martin's barbecue fatigue after six sessions at his house.
Well, I know I'm looking forward to that. Just not doing something other than being on Zoom all day.
That's right. And because of this group's being so small, we're here in person with our chief, Blake Funky, who's going to tell us about a lot of great cases that have been happening at Vanderbilt.
Welcome back, Blake. How have you been?
I've been doing well. This is my second interviewing session of the day, and so I feel like I'm ready, and I'm in the flow of interviewing, and hopefully sound less awkward than the last time.
Well, we're ready for you. What cases did you bring for us today?
I have a couple really awesome cases that I'm bringing from Vanderbilt Morning Report. The first one that we're going to talk about has a hematology flare. It's a case of a 78-year-old lady who came in with 4 days of a blistering rash on her extremities, as well as some fatigue, and also said she'd been having several months of dark black stools. I think when you first hear this case, you start to think of, you know, kind of a crazy differential of things, but the labs were really what gave this case away. So she had a pretty profound anemia with a hemoglobin of 6.1, but her coags were where the money is. She had a normal INR of 1.2 and a prolonged PTT of about 73.
Wow. Was she on any anticoagulation?
She was not. She was not taking any blood thinners. And so one of our very astute residents quickly picked up on this case as being concerning for an acquired hemophilia, which is not something that we routinely see and is somewhat rare, as we'll talk about later.
You said acquired hemophilia. Tell us a little bit more about what that is, Blake.
Absolutely. The most common cause of acquired hemophilia is autoantibodies against factor VIII, essentially an acquired hemophilia A. So if we remember back to the coagulation cascade, factor VIII is further down on the intrinsic pathway right before factor X, and the pathway becomes a common pathway. So this is why you have a prolongation of the PTT, but a normal PTINR, which would be the extrinsic pathway.
Getting flashbacks to med school, so I hope we're kind of wrapping this part up.
Yeah, just don't ask me any more questions about the coagulation cascade. If everyone at home is kind of worried that they don't know very much about acquired hemophilia and that they've never seen any cases of it, you should not be worried. It's quite rare, less than 1.5 cases per million per year.
So who gets acquired hemophilia?
Well, not very many people, as I just said before. But there are a variety of risk factors: age greater than 50, pregnancy, some autoimmune conditions, as well as malignancies. And then it can occasionally be a drug reaction as well. About 50% of the cases are idiopathic, no underlying causes identified. And interestingly, acquired hemophilia associated with pregnancy has a better prognosis.
Earlier, you said hemophilia A for factor VIII, and I know that for that condition, we would want to look at factor VIII activity. How are we going to tell the difference between a hemophilia A and this acquired hemophilia?
So a mixing study is when you take a patient's plasma and mix it with control plasma that should have all the different factors required for clotting. and see if there's a correction in this case, the PTT. In patients who have congenital hemophilia, which is low factor 8, the control plasma will have that in it, and so their PTT will correct in the mixing study. In acquired hemophilia, an inhibitor is present, such that if you give the patient control plasma with normal factors in it, the inhibitor is still there, and so the PTT still is not going to correct.
So just to clarify, in people with congenital hemophilia, the problem is not enough factor or lack of factor. So adding that back in will fix the problem and fix the PTT. But in people with acquired hemophilia, the problem is not a lack of factor, it's that you have this inhibitor. So adding more factor won't help at all, and the mixing study won't correct their PTT. Am I thinking about that correctly?
You are correct, Casey, and you probably said that better than I did, so thank you for that.
So we've got our coags, we've got our mixing study. Are there any other diagnostic tests we need to send?
Definitely. You can actually check a factor 8 activity level and an inhibitor level to confirm the diagnosis. So in this patient's case with the acquired hemophilia, she had a low factor 8 activity level and an elevated factor 8 inhibitor level, confirming the diagnosis.
And with the diagnosis confirmed, what sort of treatment options do we have?
Well, if someone's coming in with clinically significant bleeding, then first and foremost, you're going to want to control the bleeding. There are a couple options for that. In patients who have a low inhibitor level, you can try to overcome the inhibitor by giving them high concentrations of factor 8 concentrate. Another option is FEBA. And for those like myself who did not initially know what that stands for, it's factor 8 inhibitor bypassing activity. It's really just activated prothrombin complex concentrates. And if you recall just one more time back to that coagulation cascade, this will feed in downstream of factor 8 into the common pathway to help with clot formation. Now that we've controlled the bleeding, we would like to try to treat the underlying inhibitor. And we do this with steroids, usually 1 mg per kg per day of prednisone, plus or minus cyclophosphamide or rituximab.
So to recap, if someone's coming in with a bleeding crisis, we can either overwhelm the system with a lot of factor 8 or bypass and go lower in the coagulation cascade. And then once we have it controlled in terms of actually treating the disease, it's really immunosuppression with either prednisone or more targeted agents.
And that seems like a pretty high dose of steroids. How long are they going to have to be on a mg per kg?
At this point, I'm definitely going to be getting my friendly hematologist on board. My understanding is there isn't great data about which exact regimen is used and for how long, but I know that monitoring of the inhibitor levels and the factor 8 activity is important. And unfortunately, I don't think prognosis is very good with acquired hemophilia. Based on my reading, less than 30% of the cases resolve spontaneously, and there's a relapse rate of about 20%. Though again, pregnant women, for whatever reason, have a better prognosis, and their acquired hemophilia rarely recurs outside of pregnancy.
Blake, I'm really excited about this next case. I know that I was part of the teams working it up the other day in Morning Report, but why don't you take us away?
So this is a case of an elderly lady with a history of hematologic malignancy, refractory to a few therapies that had left her profoundly neutropenic. She developed fevers at home up to almost 102 Fahrenheit, as well as a very impressive, sharply demarcated erythematous rash over her lower mandible, neck, and upper chest.
So I'm hearing fever in a severely immunocompromised patient with some sort of head and neck infection. I'm already starting to get very nervous.
As you should. I would say head and neck infections are some of the ones that scare me the most because they can progress so quickly and cause airway compromise. I think several of us have heard of our colleagues having cases of Lemierre's syndrome or septic thrombophlebitis of the IJ. And then there's also the severe form of cellulitis involving the floor of the mouth, which raises our concern for impending airway compromise. Thankfully, this patient did not have either of those things, but did have a very impressive gray-based erosion along her lower mandible, kind of at the gingiva. Is there anything that you all think of, perhaps back in your microbiology days in medical school, when you think of a really immunocompromised patient, or maybe a patient with DKA who's coming in with an oral ulceration?
Those buzzwords are all making me think Mucor.
Because this was presented just recently as yet to have a final diagnosis, that was high on everyone's list. And I think it's been a while since I've really thought about Mucor, having not had any cases myself in residency. And the pathophysiology is really fascinating, so I thought we would talk about that today.
So when we say Mucor, we're of course talking about Mucor mycosis. And I suppose that you're now going to tell us a little bit about the micro and pathophysiology of how Mucor is such a terrible infection to have.
Exactly. So Mucor mycosis is the term used to describe infections caused by a group of organisms such as rhizopus, mucor, and rhizomucor. Again, these might just be buzzwords from back in your microbiology days. Like a lot of the other endemic fungal infections that we talk about here in Tennessee, these organisms are ubiquitous in nature, particularly in decaying vegetation and soil, where they can grow rapidly, they release spores that then become airborne, and we inhale them. And we're all exposed to these every day, just living our normal lives, but with an intact immune system, it does not cause us any problems.
You mentioned earlier, we think about this in this patient who's neutropenic. What are some of the other risk factors that predispose? Why isn't everyone getting this infection?
There are a number of risk factors that have been identified, all immunocompromising conditions. Perhaps the most fascinating to me is the reason that patients with poorly controlled diabetes, particularly DKA, are at risk for this. It turns out that the rhizopus species in particular has an enzyme called ketone reductase, which allows them to thrive in high glucose acidic environments, such as DKA. In the serum of normal patients, rhizopus would be inhibited, but it thrives when patients are acidemic and hyperglycemic as they are in DKA.
That's really cool.
Other risk factors include hematologic malignancies, patients who have undergone stem cell transplant, less so patients who have undergone solid organ transplant or who are on long-term steroids. Another very interesting risk factor to me is the use of deferoxamine for iron chelation.
Why is that a risk factor?
Deferoxamine acts as a siderophore and actually helps the species uptake iron, which increases fungal growth and tissue invasion.
Blake, this is so much knowledge. There can't be anything more.
Oh, but there is. Interestingly, these infections have also been associated with injuries sustained during natural disasters such as tornadoes and military combat.
And I'm assuming we don't know why?
Well, I think it's probably because in those situations, people are at risk for having dirty wound infections due to disruption of the soil, housing structures nearby, etc., and then having direct penetrating injuries.
You're dropping some real Mucor knowledge today, Blake.
Thank you.
If we're not in the middle of military combat or a natural disaster or treating someone with DKA in those situations, when should we suspect Mucor? What's the typical presentation?
Yeah, so the most common clinical presentation is rhinoorbital cerebral infection. To break that down, infection that begins in the nasopharynx and then quickly and aggressively invades into the orbits and also, unfortunately, into the CNS. Patients often present with an acute sinusitis that just progresses super quickly. Characteristically, you might see a black eschar on the palate, on the roof of their mouth, and then also significant overlying skin erythema and edema. Patients who have CNS involvement at presentation may also have some focal neurologic deficits, present with altered mental status. It can be pretty scary. Less often, people can present primarily with pulmonary involvement, usually with fevers and hemoptysis. Primary GI involvement is unusual. And then in the less common instance where people have suffered penetrating injuries and traumas, they can present with primarily cutaneous Mucor mycosis.
If we have a clinical suspicion for Mucor, how do we go about diagnosing it?
The key is to obtain tissue as soon as possible. One, because a mainstay of treatment is early and aggressive surgical debridement, but also it's important to look at the tissue underneath the microscope and actually identify the fungal organisms, and then also send it for culture.
Like, would beta-D-glucan or a galactomannan be helpful in this case?
This is one of the few cases when those would not be helpful tests. So Mucor is one of the fungi that does not have a 1,3-beta-D or galactomannan within the cell wall, and so those will not be positive in this case.
So as you said, tissue is the issue, and once we've made the diagnosis, how do we treat it?
Again, and I can't reiterate this enough, having surgical colleagues on board to do early and complete debridement is super important. But then we're also going to treat with antifungals, specifically liposomal amphotericin, if possible. And if there's a contraindication to that, posaconazole or isavuconazole can be used for step-down therapy or for salvage therapy.
For our last case today, I know that you're bringing us a discussion of high output heart failure, which is one of the diagnoses that I find really fascinating and haven't actually made myself yet. It's definitely on my top 10 to make. Would love to hear more about how Katie discovered this patient of high output heart failure.
Absolutely. This was an awesome case. To set the stage, we have a middle-aged lady with a history of a renal transplant who presented initially with several months of progressive shortness of breath, had bilateral pleural effusions, and a pericardial effusion, all of which were tapped and discovered to just be transudates. A unifying diagnosis was not discovered, but she felt better, then came back short time later with recurrence of her symptoms. She had an echocardiogram that showed normal bi-V systolic function and not really a significant recurrence of her pericardial effusion. So people were a bit stumped as to what was causing her symptoms. And so she underwent what one of my mentors calls a right heart cath of truth. The right heart cath cinched the diagnosis, and it showed increased cardiac output, suggestive of an overactive AV fistula, leading to the final diagnosis of high output heart failure.
So tell us more about what high output heart failure is.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like an oxymoron, doesn't it?
I agree. I think of heart failure in general as a lower output state. So what does this high output part mean?
So while the underlying etiology can differ, generally speaking, high output heart failure is a condition in which the cardiac output is greater than the metabolic demand, and it's characterized by a low SVR, a decreased venous arterial oxygen gradient, and high cardiac output. The underlying cause of the low systemic vascular resistance varies depending on the etiology. In the case of this patient with an AV fistula, the creation of the AV fistula resulted in blood bypassing the capillary beds, causing a decrease in systemic vascular resistance and a resultant increase in cardiac output. But the unifying theme is that the low SVR causes your body to try to compensate through all those pathways that we learned about in medical school and still in residency, RAS, etc., to retain sodium, retain water, and causes volume overload, just like the other causes of heart failure that we think about. You know, that's why these patients come in with signs and symptoms of heart failure, just like low output states like heart failure with preserved ejection fraction or reduced ejection fraction.
So in this patient, an enlarged AV fistula led to high output heart failure. What are some of the other causes that should be on our radar?
High output heart failure can also classically be seen in patients with hyperthyroidism, pregnant patients, and those with severe anemia.
So in specifically in the case of a patient with an overactive AV fistula, what do we do? Do we just cut off the fistula or is there another treatment that we can offer?
I think probably any nephrologist listening just nearly passed out at you saying, do we cut off the fistula? But as a last resort, yes, essentially. So first, you're going to try to treat these patients medically like you would any heart failure patients. If they are dialysis dependent, you're going to try to modulate their fluid status with dialysis. Or in those who have preserved renal function, you're going to use diuretics. We're also going to treat the underlying cause if there is one, correct their anemia, treat their hyperthyroidism. But specifically in patients with AV fistulas, if their symptoms persist despite medical management, you're going to consider closing the fistula. Now, in a patient who has a transplant in fine renal function, you can close the fistula that's not being used. But in our patients who are still using their fistulas and are dependent on dialysis, the other option is narrowing the diameter of the AV fistula through procedures like banding. To diagnose it, it takes a high index of clinical suspicion in addition to right heart catheterization findings. One of the coolest things, I think, is that the diagnosis can be clinched with a temporary occlusion of the AV fistula during the right heart cath to see if the hemodynamics improve with that temporary occlusion.
So to summarize, high output heart failure is a rare syndrome of heart failure characterized by increased cardiac output in response to an increased peripheral demand, which eventually leads to cardiac remodeling and increased pressures in both the left and right heart and the normal symptoms of heart failure, volume overload. To diagnose, one requires first to have a very high clinical suspicion, but really requires a right heart cath to show us increased cardiac output and low systemic vascular resistance.
That was an excellent summary, Alex.
Thank you so much, Blake. I know that last topic kind of threw me for a loop. I'm still trying to wrap my brain around it.
A final point I'd like to make is that before confirming the diagnosis with a right heart cath, A transthoracic echo can give you a clue to the diagnosis as well. You may see some RV dysfunction, RV dilation, evidence of elevated pulmonary pressures as signs that your patient has underlying high output heart failure. Casey and Alex, thanks for sticking with me. I don't think that was any less awkward than the time before, but there's plenty of year left, so there's hope for me yet.
Thanks again for being on with us, Blake. We had a great time, and stick around for our next episode with Lee Across the Street.